half-hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This is Michael Hansen. The Mind Web story this time is Young Girl at an Open Half Door by Fred Saberhagen, a tale which originally appeared in the November 1968 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, copyright 1968 by Mercury Press. That first night, there was a police vehicle, what I think they call a K-9 unit, in the little employee's lot behind the Institute. I parked my car beside it and got out. The summer moon was dull above the city's air, but floodlights glared at a small door set in the granite flank of the great building. I carried my toolbox there and pushed a button and stood waiting. Within half a minute, a uniformed guard appeared inside the reinforced glass of the door. Before he had finished unlocking, two uniformed policemen were standing beside him, and beside them, a powerful leashed dog whose ears were aimed my way. The door opened. I said, "Electronic watch," holding out my identification. The dog inspected me while the three uniformed men peered at my symbols and were satisfied. With a few words and nods, the police admitted me to fellowship. In the next moment, they were saying goodbye to the guard. He gave them a jovial farewell and locked them out. And then turning back to me, still smiling, an old and heavy man now adopting a fatherly attitude, he squinted with the effort of remembering what he had read on my identification card.
Your name, Joe?
That's right, Joe Ricci.
Well, Joe, our system's acting up. The control room's up this way.
Yes, I know. I helped install it. And I walked beside the guard, named Dan, through silent passages and silent marble galleries, all carved by nightlights into one-third brilliance and two-thirds shadow. We passed through new glass doors that were opened for us by photocells. Maintenance men in green uniforms were cleaning the glass. Dan whistled cheerfully as we went up the wide, four-branched central stair, passing under a great skylight holding out the night. From the top landing of the stair, a plane door, little noticed in the daytime, opens through classical marble into a science fiction room of fluorescent lights and electronic consoles. In that room are three large wall panels marked security, fire, and interior climate. As we entered, another guard was alone in the room, seated before the huge security panel.
Gallery 215 showed again,
the guard said, turning to us and pointing to one of the indicator lights on the panel. The little panel lights were laid out within an outline of the building's floor plan.
You'd swear it was someone in there.
I set down my kit and stood looking at the panel, mentally reviewing the general layout of the security circuitry. Electronic watch has not, for a long time, used anything as primitive as photocells, which are relegated to such prosaic jobs as opening doors. After closing hours in the Institute, when the security system is switched on, invisible electric fields permeate the space of every room where there's anything of value. A cat cannot prowl the building without leaving the track of disturbances across the security panel. At the moment, all its indicators were dim and quiet. I opened my kit, took out a multimeter and a set of probes, and began a preliminary check of the panel itself.
You'd swear someone's in 215 when it happens, and then a man starts over to investigate, and, well, before he can get there, it stops.
Of course, there was nothing nice and obvious wrong with the panel. I had not expected there would be. Neat, simple troubles are too much to expect from the complexities of modern electronic gear. I tapped the indicator marked 215, but its glow remained dim and steady. Do you get the signal from just one gallery?
Yeah, that's right. Flashing a couple times real quick on and off, and then it It stays on steady for a while, like someone's just standing in the middle of the room over there. And then, like he said, it goes off while a guy's trying to get over there. We called the officers, and then we called you.
I put the things back in my kit and closed it up and lifted it. Well, I'll walk over there and look around.
You know where 215 is? I can walk over there with you.
No, that's all right. I'll find it. I've been in here before in the daytime looking at the pictures. The guards laughed, a little relieved that I had broken my air of grim intentness. I know I often struck people that way. Walking alone through the half-lit halls, I found it pleasant to think of myself as a man who came here in two such different capacities. Electronics and art were both in my grasp. I had a good start at knowing everything of importance. Renaissance man, I thought, of the new Renaissance, of the space age. Finding the gallery was no problem, for all of them are numbered plainly, more or less in sequence. Through rising numbers, I traversed the 13th century, the 14th, the 15th. A multitude of Christs and virgins, saints and noblemen watched my passage from their walls of glare and shadow. From several rooms away, I saw the girl through a real doorway framing the painted one she stands in. My steps slowed as I entered Gallery 215. About 20 other paintings hang there, but for me it was empty of any presence but hers. That night, I had not thought of her until I saw her, which struck me then as odd, because on my occasional daytime visits, I had always stopped before her door. I had no girl of kind to take to an art gallery, whatever guards might surmise. The painter's light is full only on her face and on her left hand, which rests on the closed bottom panel of a divided door. She is leaning very slightly out through the half-open doorway, her head of auburn curls turned just an inch to the left, but her eyes looking the other way. She watches and listens, that much is certain. To me, it has always seemed that she is expecting someone. Her full, vital body is chased in a plain dark dress. Consider her attitude, her face, and wonder that so much is made of the smile of Mona Lisa. The card on the wall beside the painting reads, Rembrandt van Rijn, Dutch, 1606 to 1669. Young girl at an open half door, dated 1645. She might have been 17 when Rembrandt saw her, and 17 she has remained. While the faces passing her doorway have grown up, grown old, and disappeared wave after wave of them, she waits. I broke out of my reverie at last with an effort. My eye was caught by the next painting, Soflevin's Witch's Sabbath, which once in the daylight had struck me as amusing. When I had freed my eyes from that, I looked into the adjoining galleries, trying to put down the sudden feeling of being watched. I squinted up at the skylight ceiling of Gallery 215, through which a single glaring spotlight shone. Holding firmly to thoughts of electronics, I peered in corners and under benches where a forgotten transistor radio might lurk to interfere conceivably with the electric field of the alarm. There was none. From my kit, I took a small field strength meter, and like a priest swinging a censer, I moved it gently through the air around me. The needle swayed, as it should have, with the invisible presence of the field. There was a light gasp, as of surprise. A sighing, momentary movement in the air. Something nearby come and gone in a moment. And in that moment, the meter needle jumped over violently, pegging so that with a technician's reflex, my hand flew to switch it to a less sensitive scale. I waited there, alone, for 10 more minutes, but nothing further happened.
It's working now. I could follow you everywhere you moved,
said the guard in the chair, turning with assurance to speak to me just as I re-entered the science fiction room. Dan, the other guard, and his sandwich were gone. Something's causing interference. So, you never have any trouble with that other gallery, huh?
No. At least I've never seen any. Well, look at that now. Make a liar out of me. Something showing in 227 right now. That's modern art.
Half an hour later, I was creeping on a catwalk through a clean crawl space above Gallery 227, tracing a perfectly healthy microwave system. The reflected glare of nightlights below filtered up into the crawl space through a million holes in acoustical ceiling panels. A small, bright, auburn movement almost directly below me caught my eye. I crouched lower on the catwalk, putting my eyes close to the holes in one thin panel, bringing into my view almost the whole of the enormous room under the false ceiling. The auburn was in a girl's hair. It came near matching the hair of the girl in the painting, but that could only have been coincidence, if such a thing exists. The girl below me was alive, in the same sense I am, solid and fleshy and three-dimensional. She wore a kind of stretch suit of a green shade that set off her hair, and she held a shiny object raised like a camera in her hands. From my position, almost directly above her, I could not see her face, only the curved grace of her body as she took a step forward, holding the shiny thing high. Then she began another step, and halfway through it, she was gone, vanished in an instant from the center of an open floor. Some time passed before I eased up from the strain of my bent position. All the world was silent and ordinary, so that alarm and astonishment would have seemed out of place. I inched back through the crawl space to my borrowed ladder, climbed down, walked along a corridor, and turned a corner into the vast shadow and glare of Gallery 227. Standing in the brightly lit spot where I had seen the girl, I realized she had been raising her camera at a sculpture, a huge flowing mass of bronze blobs and curved holes on a topmost blob of face that looked like something scratched there by a child. I went up to it and thumped my knuckles on the nearest bulge of bronze, and the great thing sounded hollowly. Looking at the card on its marble base, I had begun to read "Reclining Figure, 1957," when a sound behind me made me spin around.
Was that you raising a ruckus in here about 5 minutes ago? On the board, it looked like a whole mob of people was running around.
I nodded, feeling the beginning of a strange contentment. The next day, I awoke at the usual time to afternoon sunlight pushing at the closed yellow shades of my furnished apartment to the endless street noises coming in. I had slept well and felt alert at once and began thinking about the girl. Even if I had not seen her vanish, it would have been obvious that her comings and goings at the Institute were accomplished by no ordinary prowlers' or burglars' methods. Nor was she there on any ordinary purpose. If she had stolen or vandalized, I would most certainly have been awakened early. I ate an ordinary breakfast, not noticing much or being noticed, sitting at the counter in the restaurant on the ground floor of the converted hotel where I rented my apartment. The waitress wore green, although her hair was black. Once I had tried half-heartedly to talk to her, to know her, but she had kept on working and loafing, talking to me and everyone else alike. When the sun was near going down, I started for work, as usual. I bought the usual newspaper to take along, but did not read it when I saw the headline, "Peace Talks Failing." That evening, I felt the way I supposed a lover should feel, going to his beloved. Dan and two other guards greeted me with smiles of the kind that people wear when things that are clearly not their fault are going wrong for their employer. They told me that the pseudo-prowler had once more visited Gallery 215, had vanished as usual from the panel just as the guard approached the room, and then had had several times appeared on the indicators for Gallery 227. I went to 227, making a show of carrying in tools and equipment, and settled myself on a bench in a dim corner to wait. The contentment I had known for 24 hours became impatience, and with slowly passing time, the tension of impatience made me uncontrollably restless. I felt sure that she could somehow watch me waiting. She must know I was waiting for her. She must be able to see that I meant her no harm. Beyond meeting her, I had no plan at all. Not even a guard came to disturb me. Around me, in paint and bronze and stone and welded steel, crowded the tortured visions of the 20th century. I got up at last in desperation and found that not everything was torture. There on the wall were Monet's water lilies. At first, nothing but vague, flat shapes of paint. Then the surface of a pond and a deep curve of reflected sky. I grew dizzy staring into that water, a dizziness of relief that made me laugh. When I looked away, at last the walls and ceiling were shimmering, as if the glare of the night lights was reflected from Monet's pond. I understood then that something was awry, something was being done to me, but I could not care. Giggling at the world, I stood there breathing air that seemed to sparkle in my lungs. The auburn-haired girl came to my side and took my arm and guided me to the bench where my unused equipment lay. Her voice had the beauty I had expected, though with a strange, strong accent.
Oh, I am sorry to make you weak and sick, but you insist to stay here and spend much time, the time in which I must do my work.
For the moment, I could say nothing. She made me sit on the bench and bent over me with concern, turning her head with something of the same questioning look as the girl in the Rembrandt painting. And again she said,
"Oh, I am sorry."
All right. My tongue was heavy and I still wanted to laugh. She smiled and hurried away, flowed away. Again she was dressed in a green stretch suit, setting off the color of her hair. This time she vanished from my sight in normal fashion, going around one of the gallery's low partitions. Coming from behind the partition were flashes of light. I got unsteadily to my feet and went after her. Rounding the corner, I saw three devices set up on tripods, the tripods spaced evenly around the reclining figure. From the three devices, which I could not begin to identify, little lances of light flicked like stings or brushes at the sculpture. And whirling around it like dancers on silent, rubbery feet, moved another pair of machine shapes, busy with some purpose that was totally beyond me. The girl reached to support me as I swayed. Her hands were strong, her eyes were darkly blue, and she was tall in slender curves.
"It is all right. I do no harm."
"I don't care about that. I want only not to tangle things with you."
"What?"
She smiled, as if at someone raving. She had drugged me with subtle gases in the air that sparkled in my lungs. I knew that, but I did not care. I always hold back, and I always tangle things with people. Not this time. I want to love you without any of that. This is a simple miracle, and I just want it to go on. Now, tell me your name." She was so silent and solemn for a moment watching me that I feared I had angered her. But then she shook her head and smiled again.
"My name is Day El. Now, don't fall down."
and she took her supporting arm away. For the moment, I was content without touching her. I leaned against the partition and looked at her busy machines. Will you steal our reclining figure?
Steal? The two greatest works of this house I must save. I will replace them with copies so well made no one will ever know before. Only you will ever know.
Then she turned away to give closer attention to the silent and ragingly busy machines. When she made an adjustment on a tiny thing she held in her hand, there were suddenly two reclining figures visible, one of them smaller and transparent, but growing larger, moving toward us from some dark and distant space that was temporarily within the gallery. I was thinking over what Dayelle had said. Addled and joyful, I plotted what seemed to me a clever compliment and announced, I know what the two greatest works in this house are.
Oh?
One is Rembrandt's Girl.
You are right. Last night, I took that one to safety. Where I take them, the originals, they will be safe forever.
But the best is you. I make you my girl, my love, forever if it can be, but how long, that doesn't matter.
If you could mean that, then I would stay with you, in spite of everything.
My arms went around her and I could feel forever passing. Stay. Stay, of course I mean it. Stay with me.
Come, Dayelle. Come.
Intoned a voice, soft, but still having metal in its timbre. Looking over her shoulder, I saw the machine shapes waiting, balancing motionless now on silent feet. There was again only one reclining figure. My thoughts were clearing, and I said to her, You're leaving copies, you said, and no one will know the difference before what? What's going to happen? When my girl did not answer, I held her at arm's length. She was shaking her head slowly, and tears had come into her eyes.
It does not matter what happens, since I have found here a man of my life who will love me. In my world, there's no one like that. If you will hold me, I can stay.
My hands holding her began to shake, and I said, I won't keep you here to die in some disaster. I'll go with you instead.
Come, Dayelle. Come.
And she stepped back, compelled by the machine voice now that I had let her go. And she said to me,
You must not come. My world is safe for paint, safe for bronze, not safe for men who love. Why do you think that we must steal?
She was gone. The machines and lights gone with her. The reclining figure stands massive and immobile as ever. Bronze blobs and curved holes of the face like something scratched on by a child. Thump it with a knuckle and it sounds hollowly. Maybe 300 years perspective is needed to see it as one of the two greatest in this house. Maybe eyes are needed, accustomed to more dimensions than ours. Eyes of those who sent Dayelle diving down through time to save choice fragments from the murky wreckage of the new Renaissance, plunged in the mud of the ignorant and boastful 20th century. Not that her world is better.
Safe for paint, safe for bronze, not safe for men who love.
I could not live there now. The painting looks unchanged. A girl of 17 still waits, frozen warmly in Rembrandt's light. 300 years and more on the verge of smiling, secure that long from age and death and disappointment. But will a war incinerate her next week, or an earthquake swallow her next month? Or will our city convulse and die in mass rioting madness, a witch's Sabbath come true? What warning can I give? When they found me alone and weeping in the empty gallery that night, they talked about a nervous breakdown. The indicators on the security panel are always quiet now. And I have let myself be argued out of the little of my story that I told. No world is safe for those who love. Young Girl at an Open Half Door, written by Fred Saberhagen, and copyright 1968 by Mercury Press. I'm Michael Hansen. Reading with me was Madeline the Traveler. The recording engineer was Mike Burns. Mindwebs is produced at WHA, Madison.